Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind the scenes photos, videos, and interviews and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact about my guest today. When he was in high school, a Broadway actor came to his small town to work with the local theater. That same Broadway actor did an interview for the local newspaper, and in it says, "This kid is pretty great and could have a professional life in the theater." Welcome, Brian Darcy James.
A-OK.
Hey everyone, my guest today is the unbelievably talented actor Brian Darcy James. His list of illustrious theater credits include 13 Broadway shows. They include Hamilton, Something Rotten, Macbeth, Time Stand Still, Next to Normal, Shrek the Musical, The Apple Tree, The Lieutenant of Inishmore, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Sweet Smell of Success, Titanic, Carousel, and Blood Brothers. Some of his films are All These Small Moments, Civil, Felt, Ghost Town, Friends with Kids, Admission, and the Academy Award-winning film Spotlight. Some of his many TV credits include 13 Reasons Why, Mozart in the Jungle, Law & Order SVU, Smash, The Good Wife, and The Big C. He has a Christmas album. He's on over 7,000 Broadway cast albums. He's been nominated or won every possible award a Broadway star can be nominated or awarded. And I am so thrilled to welcome Brian Darcy James to the podcast.
Hi, Alana.
This is an incredible thrill because it is rare for me to be able to say that I have seen every single Broadway show that my guest has been in.
Wow.
It's extraordinary. I was looking at your list and I thought, wow, I've had a lot of time on my hands.
Or you just love theater, which you
I
do.
I love theater so much. And, you know, it's also kind of a rare treat. Obviously, predominantly, you have done musicals. But I also saw Time Stand Stills. I mean, you're very fluid in comedy and drama, and you can get cast in all sorts of things, which must be a really nice thing to have accomplished at this point.
I try to. There's one kind of bridge that I can point to that I think was instrumental in me believing that that was more possible than I thought maybe imaginable, which was in 93. I was doing Carousel, and I auditioned for a production of a play by Kenneth Branagh at the Irish Arts Center called Public Enemy. I can't remember how I came across the knowledge of it. Maybe it was a backstage thing.
Maybe you were stalking Kenneth Branagh.
Maybe.
That could be
maybe
happening
I
too.
Was.
Yes. That's another story.
Yes. But Laura Richin, who is the casting director, was instrumental in having me come in at some point or another. And I never forgot what she said. She was very generous about, well, and maybe just a good casting director in the sense that she said, I never exclude people who do musicals because they innately understand the rhythm and the rhythm of a play as well as music. And so
literally.
Exactly. Yeah. So she gave me a chance to audition for this play, and it was my first real play in New York City, which was important to me. I wanted to do that. And so I left Carousel a little early, and I think a lot of people thought I was a little insane, you know, because Broadway is definitely a destination, and I feel extraordinarily lucky to have done one Broadway show.
But you've done 1,000 Broadway shows. So.
A baker's dozen, I think they call it.
Definitely.
Which is such a weird expression.
I know. You'll like order your bagels. I'll be like a dozen bagels and then I'll get home. And they were like, that is so, I'm like, honey, they gave me an extra one. And Dominic's like, no, it's not that they like you more than everybody else.
That's
it's
just the rule
an
of the bakers.
Program.
Yeah. What is 11? I wonder. It's like, there's gotta be a term for that.
Loser.
A loser's dozen.
Loser's dozen, I'm sure.
But anyway, I go back to Laura Richin, who actually was really helpful in kind of not excluding a musical guy, quote unquote, for having the chance or the opportunity to audition for a play and maybe do a play.
That's amazing. Well, and now you got a chance publicly to thank her.
Yeah.
So our work is done here.
Yep. Good night, everybody.
Thank you so much, Brian. This was amazing. So you're from Michigan.
Right.
Did you grow up in a musical household?
Yes and no. I'd say yes in the sense that no more musical than anyone who has parents that might put an album on or two. I mean, my mom was a big pop fan, so she would listen to Stevie Wonder, and I remember listening to Sergio Mendez and, you know, Up and Away in my Fifth Dimension.
Yeah.
So those are the albums that were playing. Burt Bacharach was...
That song doesn't get sung enough.
Up and Away.
Yeah.
My Beautiful Balloon.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back.
Let's do... 54 Below.
I'm just going to sing this song for the next 20 minutes on your podcast.
And it's called Up, Up, and Away. We've got Robbie, do you know Robbie Rizal?
Yeah.
I see the graphic. It's all happening. Yes. It's going to be amazing.
This is a terrible idea.
This is a terrible idea, except to us. All right. Anyway.
So my dad was a big jazz guy. On his turntable was, or his collection was, you know, Manhattan Transfer and Errol Garner and, you know, just some of the more swinging cats of the 40s and the 50s. Buddy Greco is another one that comes to mind. So anyway, that was the music that I was listening to, and I always enjoyed singing. And my older sister, Anne, we are 2 years apart, and then there's a 5-year gap between my younger brother and my younger sister. So Anne and I were kind of, you know, in the same...
One set.
Yeah, in the pod together. And she was always very musical, and it wasn't really until she got into high school where she discovered the love of theater and started doing musicals and has this beautiful voice and was using it. And it was interesting for me to witness that, you know, having the transition from singing in our
living room yeah.
to the radio or to the stereo to watching her perform. And that was extraordinary for a couple of reasons. A, to see my sister do that. And then also just have the ability to have a school that, as most schools do, have chances for people to do musicals and plays and, you know, get
Were you Sporty Spice before that? Like,
I kind of was, actually.
Yeah.
I really was. I was spending all my time in the side yard playing football, baseball. I mean, I played a lot of sports. I love sports. And so... You know, somewhere around my 9th or 10th grade, everyone started growing, and I did not. I was pretty small, and so I started to reconsider, you know, what it meant to be on the football team after a couple of hard hits, you know, and thinking, well, this might not be very, very wise.
Was that a painful thing for someone at 15 or 16 to not be growing?
I was aware of it. And but mostly on the sports field. It didn't really affect me in
Not
terms of...
Not a problem with the ladies.
I don't know about that. I don't think there was any
there
radar
were no ladies.
Of that. Yeah, no ladies.
So not a problem.
Not a problem, exactly.
Exactly.
You are correct in saying that.
Thank you, sir.
It's an interesting question. I do remember being aware of it. And I was never afraid of you know, playing football or getting you know, tagged or whatever on the field. But it was, I think, it was a confluence of events of what was happening just with me as a kind of a squirt, And then finding out, like in eighth grade, that I could sing, and singing in public, and the identity, if you will, that I was able to kind of hold on to or start to explore, of what that did for my confidence, the exploration of what music meant to me. We went to a lot of community plays and musicals. I grew up in mid-Michigan, so we would drive down to Detroit to the Fisher Theater and see, you know, touring productions of Annie was a big one for me, I remember. Weren't you in Annie? Were you
know,
in Annie?
They say in improv to always say yes and. Yes and.
No, you weren't. No, I for some reason
I was in Charlie, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
I know that.
Which also is.
No,
is
I know. I thought maybe as a child you were in Annie.
As a child, I listened to Annie.
Yeah.
And I loved it. But no, when we actually edit this episode and put it out in the world, when you say, were you in Annie? I'm going to be like, yeah, I was.
And I was Annie.
And it's the listener's problem if they can't find on IBDB where.
Right.
That's on them,
right,
Brian.
Right.
So ask me again if I was in Annie.
So you were in Annie, right?
Yes. It was amazing.
You were
you
wonderful.
Kidding?
I saw you in Detroit.
The Fox.
Yes.
Is that the Fox in Detroit?
There is. I think there's the Fox. At my time, it was the Fisher Theater.
Well, I'm a lot younger than you, Brian. So when I did it, it was the Fox.
Yeah. Actually, I think I saw you as Pepper.
I started as Pepper, and then I went on to be Annie. And
right.
Then I don't know if you're aware what happened, but I got a huge contract with Disney as a kid.
I remember this.
And then Andrea McArdle, at the last minute, she had been my understudy.
Right.
And then they had her go on, and it's one of those kind of like crazy, the way Sutton Foster took over for Kristen and Millie.
Sure, sure.
And look what happened.
Right.
So, yeah, so like Sutton, Andrea is going to be on Younger.
Wow, you figured the whole thing out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, I think our work here is done.
Thank you to that casting director. Was it Laura?
Laura Richin.
Yeah, yeah. She cast it. She's amazing. I owe her a great debt.
Yeah.
There are all of these kind of seminal moments mm-hmm. in our life that got us from the town we grew up in.
Right.
To Hamilton,
right,
which is,
right.
By the way, in case people weren't clear when I did his list of Broadway credits, one of them is Hamilton. And if you don't know what it is, look it up because it's good. It's pretty good.
I'd say it's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
But you know what? That's me. And I'm not here to put my opinions out and like, this is, it's up to you. I feel like you would agree that it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's all right.
It's all right. I mean, you've done a lot of stuff, so we'll get to that. It's no The Apple Tree.
Right. This is true.
What was your aha moment that made you think you could do this professionally? Like maybe you got something special going on.
If I was a junior in high school and I was doing a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, I grew up in a town called Saginaw, Michigan, and 20 minutes away is a town called Midland, Michigan. And each town has their own vibrant community theater programs. And, you know, someone at that point, I was really very interested in trying to kind of do everything I could to be on stage. And so it wasn't unusual for kids from Saginaw to audition for the Midland plays and Midland kids to audition for the Saginaw plays and et cetera.
Cross-pollinate.
Yeah, exactly. It's a relatively small community, but a great community in that way. So anyway, I ended up doing this production of Joseph. And what was really interesting, it was directed by a guy named Dean Bottolato. Dean Bottolato is a New York City resident, and to his credit, he's a Broadway dancer and a choreographer. Choreographer, I'm in the business. I know how to say words.
Well, we've just figured it out.
Yeah, he's a choreographer.
It's all a lie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're not Brian Darcy James Knoll.
Get out.
You would know it's a choreographer.
Is that how you say it? I've been saying it so wrong. Anyway,
oh, don't worry.
Dean Bottolato, the choreographer. you just literally spit out your coffee.
I am so sorry. That's the first time that's happened. I'm really sorry. Brian, I'm sorry you had to see that.
No, I don't care.
I mean, I pride myself on my spit takes, but usually it's like it's because I've crafted the moment, but
that was an actual, it wasn't even a spit take, because a spit take is conscious. You just abruptly spit out your coffee.
I laughed so hard because it was going to come out of my nose, and I was like, that would be horrible. Sorry, that's oh. how. So, do you do a lot of comedy? Because you should.
I should now. I'm putting it on my resume.
By the way, it takes a lot for me to do that. So you should just know.
I'm very proud.
You should be really proud.
I'm very proud.
And I hope that will that image will not be branded on your forehead. We're talking about Dean.
Dean Bottolato.
Yes.
He was in the production of Pirates of Penzance in the park with Rex Smith and Linda Ronstadt, and he was in it. And
maybe I didn't see it.
Okay, I think you did. Anyway, so he had an association with this theater company in Midland, which was fantastic. It was very well funded and had a lot of support. And so they brought in this Broadway guy. And that was really interesting, you know, and...
Well, to work with the real deal, right?
Well, exactly.
I mean, community theater is filled with incredible people.
Right.
Often, but to actually have, like, a New York Broadway person
yeah.
come must have been very,
very uncommon.
Exciting.
Very yeah. exciting. And just, he had that, the magic dust on him. So, all of which to say is
you
that...
You slept with him.
If I had milk in my mouth, it would be all over the table
if
right
I
now.
I had a little magic dust for every time... Dean and I.
No, yes, he's
that's a... not what happened.
It isn't. So the moment that was my Dean moment was that he was interviewed in the Saginaw News, just as a matter of course, about the upcoming production. And he said in the paper, he said, yes, we've got this kid named Brian James who's playing Joseph, and he's pretty great. And I think if he wanted to, he could probably have a professional career in the theater.
Holy
and I remember
hell.
Reading that in the paper,
yeah,
in the Saginaw News, and just it stopped me. It really stopped me, because what a nice thing to say, and what a nice thing to say publicly. And it really had an enormous effect on me. It just gave me one more cleat in my shoe to kind of look at the mountain and say, okay, I've got the proper equipment to do this. You know,
I just
kind of...
had this image of you getting off the bus when you came to New York with that like one piece of paper.
Yeah, the Saginaw News.
Hey.
Yeah.
Mr. Ziegfeld.
Check this out. Dean Bottolato says I'm a star.
Says he could be on Broadway.
Yeah.
This is Broadway,
famous choreographer,
right?
Bottolato. Chimes in on James's. Anyway.
But kind of, right? Like, if you think about what you put in your
yeah.
suitcase
yeah.
of confidence,
yeah.
and you then like, okay, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to study this.
That's
and...
right. So that was a significant moment for me in my early days. But, you know, truly, there are moments like that you can isolate and you can just think about for a second and think, wow, if that person hadn't allowed me to do this or given me the chance to try and fail here, I wouldn't be here.
Just to fast forward for a moment, you did go to Northwestern?
I did.
Were you a theater arts major there?
I was, yeah. You get a Bachelor of Science, interestingly, at Northwestern when you study
actors
theater.
Because actors use a lot of science.
Yeah, well, you know, it's I think it's kind of just an arcane thing that they do for the school. I don't know exactly why they designate it that way. I have no problems with you know, having a BS in theater.
It is a BS.
In a way, it is. That's what you're learning to do. It's a valuable pursuit, and it's a valuable effort to spend your time in any institution studying the arts. I've always contended that you know, an acting class is the best history, sociology, psychology class
Agreed.
You could take.
Absolutely.
And you know, because it does force you to understand, you know, let alone the structure and the what goes into writing a play. But the context, the implications, the character, all of that. So,
yes. As well as, for me, it still remains many of the people that I met at that time in my first theatrical community
mm-hmm.
helped me understand the idea of family,
mm-hmm.
kind of your theatrical family. When you graduated, what literally happened for you?
I moved to New York April Fool's Day of 1991.
To be exact.
Yeah, no, I'll never forget it.
And where did you, like, did you have a friend that you went
I
to live
with? I stayed
with
my cousin, Matt, and on the Upper East Side, and crashed with him a couple of days, and then moved in with a buddy of mine from Northwestern, and, you know, I was just crashing on people's couches until I could, you know, find a place to stay. Backstage, you know, you get your backstage and you
it was
you,
a newspaper.
That's right. Yeah.
yeah.
You circle the auditions that you think you're right for and you go stand in line at an open call.
When did Blood Brothers happen?
this is an interesting story. So Blood Brothers, my sister, who I mentioned earlier, was very aware of all the things that were happening in the world theatrically, and she spent a semester abroad. She went to Boston College, and then I think she saw a production of Blood Brothers while she took a trip to London in 1988, something like that.
Yeah.
And she loved the score, and she said, "Oh, Brian, I think you really like the score." I'm a pop music fan. That's kind of my filter. That's what I like the most. Anyway, so I was aware of that score quite early on. I'd never seen it, but there was the production that was happening that ultimately came to the Broadway show was in Toronto, and I had a dear friend named Sam Samuelson, who is now an agent in Chicago, who was in that production. And we had moved to New York at the same time, and he had to leave to go to Toronto with this possible Broadway show, which was really exciting. You know, it was one of your friends, like, all right.
Yeah, it's happening.
Exactly.
I'm getting close.
Exactly.
Because I know someone who
That's
knows
right.
someone.
That's right.
Totally. So everything's possible.
Yeah, exactly. And then it got interesting because Sam called me and said, you know, we're coming to Broadway, and you should know that one of the guys who's in this production is going to be leaving to do a great actor named Philip Lale, who was in that production, who went to go do a play called The Kentucky Cycle,
which I think
he'd been a part of before and was just going to see it out, his association with it. And so there was a slot opening. And so Sam let me know, and I auditioned for this show, and I got it. And so what was really cool is that I got it right before the...
rent was due.
Yes, the rent was due, so I knew
I could
survive another week. But I remember I was going to go in the week after the Tony Awards, and so I was watching the Tony Awards, watching the show, thinking, "Oh my God, I'm going to be in that show."
You know, you mentioned this guy was leaving Blood Brothers to finish out something he had already been a part of, the Kentucky Cycle,
right.
And then that allowed an opportunity for you, which reminds me a little bit of a more modern version of that story, which was my friend Brian Darcy James was in a production of Hamilton at the Public Theater. A show he had been a part of called Something Rotten had an opportunity for him to go forward with it. You had been a part of Something Rotten before you came on to Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And so you left, giving a kid named Jonathan Groff an opportunity. So you're the Sam in the story.
Right.
And then this thing, both these things, it's kind of an extraordinary thing because had you joined something and it was kind of like wah wah, right? It would have been a bigger bummer.
Right.
But the thing you left to go do was kind of extraordinary and Tony-nominated worthy. So can we talk a little bit about that chapter?
Sure,
Is that something you're comfortable
No, I think absolutely. It's a great example of sometimes the decisions you have to make as a professional. And one of the variables in that was a timetable issue of Something Rotten, thinking that was going to be a little further off in the distance. And basically it was...
Were you with Hamilton back at New York Stage and Film, like from the beginning?
I did the first act reading or workshop
okay.
in a room with about eight or nine actors with Lynn, figuring out the first act.
Quite early on, like the very first?
I don't know, to be honest, what the history is. Maybe there were iterations before that, but that was pretty early.
Okay.
Because it was just the first act, and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do and how they're going to do it. And then,
did you know Lynn or any of those people before
I had
Hamilton?
I had met Lynn socially. You know, Lynn is such a he's such an avid theater fan. First of all, he's a genius, but on top of that, he's just he just loves the theater. And
right.
so, I met him at an event for the New York Musical Theater Festival, and he was performing. Because In the Heights was brewing, and he was there. It was honoring Kevin McCollum, the producer, and so Lynn did like a freestyle thing, and everyone was like, "What's going on? What is this?" So I kind of met him a couple of times, and so you know he very nicely asked me to come in and say, "Could you sing this for this thing?" And Tommy Kail was instrumental in that as well, the director. And so that was the beginning of my association with the show.
And does the songs as we know them now for King George, Brian plays King George, are they were Did that exist?
Yes.
Did, okay.
That was there when I in fact, I was just going back in my, I have, you know, just a recording of that rehearsal because all these memories had come up by joining the company again. And I just wanted to kind of go back to the beginning and see if there's something I could learn about the song or about, you know, just figuring out like what this is, go back to square one, hear things that Alex Lacamoire, our musical director and orchestrator, you know, if he had anything to say in those initial stages that might be helpful to me unlock something.
Did he? Were there?
Yeah, there were like different things in phrasing and also yes to that, but also the way that Lynn sang it on the demo, you know, finding clues about maybe what he was intending. You know, all those things I'm really interested in,
sure.
in trying to the nooks and crannies of a song. So I got,
you did the reading.
I did the reading, and then I think there was the Vassar reading after that I couldn't do, and then there was another reading at the 52nd Street Project on the West Side. That was the first act staged, and the second act, basically a concert reading of it, and that's when it became clear that this is extraordinary, because not only did you have the words, but you had Andy Blankenbuehler's work all of a sudden popping up like this crazy 3D, you know, pop-up book that you're experiencing in a completely new way, albeit very bare bones.
Yeah.
Which in a way is still part of the overall design of the show. Because if you look at it, the structure of it in terms of what you're seeing, you know, any kind of formation that you see is happening with this ensemble of actors, you know, by virtue of their incredible athleticism, finesse, all of the things that bring Andy's choreography or choreography.
I think it's choreography.
I think so too, to life. So I'm going to be damned.
I hope you present choreography at the Tonys this year.
It will be my destiny at the Tonys. So yeah, my association with the show, I just feel very lucky to have been a part of it. And to make a long story short, hopefully, the Something Rotten experience was brewing at the same time. I had done a reading of it, and at that time, there was going to be a production, I think, that was going to go out of town in Seattle, and that was something that was a possibility down the road.
Right.
And after the reading, I knew this is a great opportunity and a great show and something that I loved. And it's just classic musical comedy. And it's something I've done, but hadn't had too much chance of really biting into. And
such an original, unique,
yeah,
hilarious.
All original, nothing, yeah. Based on nothing, but a great, great idea. And so that was something that I knew that I wanted to do. And then a theater opened up. They were announcing that they were going to go to Broadway much sooner than expected. And so
Something Rotten, exactly.
Yeah. So I had a decision to make, because I knew that the Public Theater's production was going to be in conflict with that.
Did you know that before you started at the Public?
No.
You'd
I didn't.
Be gone.
I knew. No, sorry. Before the show started.
Before Hamilton started at the Public, did you have any dates for Something Rotten?
Yes, I did. In fact,
you started at the Public knowing that you would be leaving to do Something Rotten.
I had made my decision because I had to choose.
How did you make the decision?
Well, I knew that. Well, first of all, I have to thank Oscar Eustace, you know, because he was producing the show, and Jeffrey Seller, who is now the Broadway producer, but he was obviously very involved in the production. And so I basically, you know, wrestled with it and said, okay, I know there's two parts to this answer. The first is making the decision about what kind of work that I wanted to do, and weighing the opportunity and trying to understand, you know, follow my gut, basically, and my heart. And my heart was saying, you know, I really want the opportunity to take this responsibility. It was a big role. It was a big, big thing. I like maybe going back to my sports days. Maybe I'm trying to fulfill some kind of thing that I didn't get a chance to be the quarterback. You know,
yes.
I like that. I like having the ball.
Yeah.
And
you had
so,
it a lot.
Well, I mean, it's
a lot more stage time.
Well,
for
it's,
sure.
It's not necessarily about the time. It's just about what it is that what the role was, the function of the role. And so on top of it being really funny and really silly and great music, all the things that
we're
that,
all was Christian. Were all of those people already?
Yeah,
you had already workshopped.
We
it
had
together.
Done it before, so yeah. we knew what it was, and we knew kind of how we all felt buzzing doing it. So that's the very brief kind of description of maybe what led me to make the decision about the kind of work that I was going to do. And then, of course, there was the decision to say, you know, to the public, I have this thing that I'm going to do. It's going to be in conflict with the off-Broadway production, and I have to go do this, and I'm really sorry. And this is terrible for you because it's quite close to when you're starting. Nobody wants to have a piece of the puzzle pulled out, you know, when you're putting something together. And Oscar, you know, we talked on the phone. He goes, thank you for telling me. I'm going to talk to everybody involved and we'll get back to you. And so there was like a couple of days where I thought, well, that was it. I could have been a part of it. And I just have to kind of make peace with it.
Did you know what it was at the time?
I had a feeling. But of course, I didn't know what.
I mean, it would be incomprehensible, right?
To understand,
like, we're going to the moon for the first time.
Exactly.
But we do know there's a spaceship and there's a moon.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's all those things. You could see the equation on the chalkboard,
yeah.
Like in a NASA movie.
In that
you know?
Hidden figures sort of
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You could see, wow, this is quite possible. So, yes, I had a sense. And. More than a sense, because we did it, and we were able to kind of inhabit these characters and move around and breathe the air that these characters would breathe. Anyway, they allowed me to do the first 6 weeks,
and so crazy.
It is.
I'll
never stop thanking them all for that.
They made Sophie's Choice like not Sophie's Choice.
Yeah, it was extraordinary, and so. That was...
But what a testament to you, Brian, and they didn't want to do it without you.
Or they just couldn't get somebody else in the 2 days. You know, that, I mean, it's quite possible, right? It totally is.
Well, I'm sure there's all...
I appreciate
maybe.
You saying
yeah,
that, but there are practical concerns,
that's
you know?
True.
You know,
but it wasn't literally 2 days. Like, it was...
I think it was 2 days from the time that they said, we have to figure out what we're going to do.
It was literally two days.
I think so.
Okay.
It was pretty quickly. It was pretty quickly my you know... My anxiety was relieved. You know, it could have gone because, like I said, it was quite soon before rehearsals started. And again, you know, you hate to be the person who's going to be like, hey, by the way, see you later.
I know, and that's not
whether it's Hamilton or anything else.
My podcast,
which I canceled 6 times.
Did you?
No, only 5. And.
Wait a
counting.
Minute.
I didn't.
I don't remember you canceling.
Maybe this is like my bag. Like he's the guy that always just checks
they
out.
They just said, you're coming in on Tuesday. And I was like, great. So
they.
So did you ever have a moment's regret?
Not a moment's regret. I don't regret it. What I have pangs, and I'll be totally selfish with you, honestly, about my selfishness, which is, you know, the pangs were watching this thing. And, you know, I joke like my last show, Bill and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton all came.
Came to say goodbye.
They came to say goodbye.
It was really sweet.
It was nice of them to come.
They're right outside this booth.
There's
also.
There's a funny story about that, actually.
Tell me.
So in 1998, I sang at the Kennedy Center Honors, and Bill Clinton was the president. And part of when you're asked to do that, you get to go to the East Room and meet the president and the first lady. My wife Jennifer and I were so excited to do that, and we were in line, and we were getting closer, and we had these really, you know, brief but wonderful conversations with Bill and Hillary Clinton. We had just gotten engaged, and we were telling them about this, and you know, I distinctly remember Hillary Clinton being super cool about it. She's like, "Wow, where'd you guys get engaged?" I mean, she was just really
interested,
and you know, and of course that was their that was their charm. Everybody knew that, especially Bill, right?
Yeah.
Which was completely true in our experience. So that's a memorable experience. Cut to the last day of the show. My wife is there because it's my last show. My daughter's there as well. And the Clintons are there, and after the show, either I think the house management got them down to the green room pretty quickly, and the public green room is a pretty small room in the basement. It's really no great shakes. It's a couch and a Coke machine, and you know, it's really quite pedestrian. Well, my wife knew how to get down there pretty quickly as well, and so everyone's getting into their street clothes, you know, out of their costumes, and my wife is there with Hillary Clinton, and she's just kind of sitting there. And my wife, who's amazing, I said, "What compelled you to talk to her?" And she goes, "Well, didn't want her to feel like she was sitting alone." And so she had a good excuse too, because she said, "You know, Secretary Clinton, we had the pleasure of meeting." And she goes on and she kind of reminds her of everything I just told you about our first encounter with the Clintons. So now we're all out in the green room.
The cast has arrived.
The cast is outside, and everyone's, you know, just
excited,
really excited. And of course, everyone's very engaged with, you know, Bill's over there talking to Oak or Davy Diggs, and Chelsea's talking to Lynn and Tommy, whatever. And I see Hillary Clinton, and I say, "Madam Secretary, I just want to remind you, thank you for coming, but I just want to say I had the pleasure of meeting you in 1988. And she goes, "Oh, yes. I remember your wife and you had just gotten engaged, and you were in Costa Rica." And I was like,
whoa.
I couldn't believe it. I was just thinking, wow, we really made an impression on her.
Because she doesn't meet a lot of people.
No, I'm like, wow.
Wait, was Jennifer standing next to you just going,
No. She wasn't anywhere where I could see her, because if she had heard me, I'm sure she probably was saying, I told her everything
2 minutes ago.
But of course, it sank in very quickly. It's like, this is impossible. She must have some kind of weird, like, cheat sheet that she just has.
That's like, incredible. Or anyway. Like a little earpiece.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
1998, yes, exactly. Brian exactly. Darcy James sang from, I believe it was... Sweet Smell of Success.
Right.
That's incredible.
Anyway, it was a funny moment.
So you got that.
My Pang. So going back to My Pang. So that was my last show. And then I think maybe the next night after I left, Paul McCartney came. And then the next night, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I was like, wow, what is that like? What must that be like? And I had experienced a little bit of that, you know, at the public for sure, because it was just starting to come out of its cocoon and people were aware of it. And there were some really interesting people that were coming. And so anyway, to answer your question, I don't regret the decision whatsoever. I had the most extraordinary time doing something rotten and met amazing people and have made new friends. And I'm really proud.
I feel like Paul McCartney's assistant came to see Something Rotten.
Paul McCartney's assistant?
And then, like, there were a lot of assistants who came. I mean, it wasn't the same.
Right.
It was like, God,
right.
Amazing. Are you kidding
me?
Everybody came to see that. I mean, you guys, that's what's so incredible about this story. You know, Celia Keenan-Bolger was on the show and she was talking about Light in the Piazza happening and not getting to go forward with it and feeling like...
Yeah. Oh, and mind you, I've got a lot of those stories as well.
But then she was also nominated the same year for Spelling Bee. And sitting next to Kelly O'Hara at the Tonys. And so I'm just saying that, like, it's not like you did it for the show that, you know, the poster went up at Joe's the next day because it was a bomb. Like, you were in this incredible, game-changing, hilarious, making thousands and thousands and thousands of people happy
in a
brilliant comedic performance that remains, you know... etched in people's minds forever. So that's the beauty of this story.
It is beautiful. I feel I got my cake and I got to eat it as well. And now I'm like just like smothered in cake because I'm back in it. And so, you know, I think if there's any, if without sounding too immodest, I mean, I think the in these kinds of situations, there's two things at play: the practicality of work and figuring out what's going to be best for me and my family. And then also the idea of, like, what is it that I'm drawn to do? What is the kind of work that I really want to do that's going to make my heart happy, that's going to challenge me as an artist, that's going to challenge me as an actor? So those are all the things that go into it.
And working from a pure place, right? Like,
exactly.
Not going, the pure ambition place or the popularity contest,
but
taking a risk on what's going to feed me.
Yeah, don't do it for what you see are going to be the bells and whistles that might come with it. Do it because the story is fascinating. Do it because it has something to say. Do it because it's going to be challenging to you as an actor, and you really want to. you really want to go down that road. I mean, that's, like I say, it's actor talk. But I think that's the thing that kind of I hope is motivating me and kind of guiding me through those situations.
Can you put into words what it is like being inside this thing now? Is there?
I'll try. You know, my description of it starts when I saw the Broadway production for the very first time when I was going to go back in as a new employee of Hamilton.
Yeah.
As you do, you watch the show to see how you're going to fit into it. Now, of course, in my experience, I had a version in my head that I did. This was different in a couple different ways, not vastly, but, you know, different stage, obviously, new material. And I hadn't seen it since the last production at the Public. I saw Jonathan do it down there and the rest of the company, who was brilliant, by the way. And so my experience of watching the show was first as a spectator. And what I felt,
I can't believe you got a ticket.
I know. It's almost impossible.
That's how you get a ticket. You have to be going
to be
into the
it.
Show.
Yeah.
All right. Note to self.
Get on it.
Oh, I'll show them my Annie reel.
And your spit take reel.
Spit take. They need that.
They need more spit takes in Hamilton.
It's a little serious.
Founding fathers were good at that. I mean, they were really good at spit takes. The experience I had was watching the crowd and really like looking at everybody, and just it's palpable, the excitement that everybody there has, as I said before, kind of gone through the eye of the needle to get there.
Exactly.
And
what a great way to describe
it. Like a year
it.
And a half of
yeah.
like figuring out how they're going to do it, and now they're finally here. And the great thing about this is that can be a double-edged sword because you can have that excitement and then you see it and it's like, wah, wah.
What's all that
I
hype?
Waited for all this?
Yeah.
Not the case with the show. Not the case. To a person, I think. And so that was interesting. In fact, there was a woman who was sitting next to me and I must have been like getting into it because I was, you know, the music is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And
there's plenty of pop for you to love.
Exactly.
There's
exactly.
Everything, but lots of amazing
I'm a hip hop ignoramus, so
right.
I'm still figuring out like, you know, what the quotes are and the references are. At any rate, this woman said to me, she goes, "You really like this show, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I really do." And she goes, "How many times have you seen it?" And I was torn because I wanted to say, "I'm going to be the king." But I didn't. I had to think and I had to answer. Honestly, I said, "I've seen it one time." And she goes, "I've seen it five times."
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, "Wow, that's good. You must like it too." She goes, "Oh, I love it." She goes, "I have to get back tonight because I drove up from Baltimore and I have to get back to see my daughter. So I'm going to have to leave a little early. But I know how it ends." And so she... I mean, that's it. Like that times 1,400 every single night, which, look, it's such a great reminder that anytime you step on a stage, you got to assume that everybody there is feeling that way. And the responsibility that we have to do our jobs.
Yeah.
And I get a little tingly talking about it because I feel that way whenever I'm sure you do as well. Whenever you go to the theater, you just like, when that light goes down, it's about to start. You're like, ooh, something's going to happen,
yeah.
you know? And I love that.
I'm nervous
love it.
For everyone. I'm excited
yeah.
for everyone.
You want it to be great.
I'm relieved I'm watching.
Yes.
I don't have to be doing
yeah,
it. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things going on. And so, you know, with this show, it's the expectation is the difference.
The thing that people know at this point is that the kind of expectation that the audience has of and for King George is enormous, and what you deliver is enormous. And I'm going to ask you at the end to just sing like a moment, just because in lieu of paying me, I'm just going to ask you to sing to be on my podcast. But There's also the kind of, you know, the story involved in it is that your stage time is like 9 minutes
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, I think something like that, yeah.
So what an extraordinary thing, right, to be able to live or to do that kind of thing. What do you do backstage the rest of the time?
Oh, this is a great question. I'm not good at multitasking. I can't sit there and read a book and just know that.
You're not a knitter.
I'm not a knitter, as everyone knows.
And that's on your resume.
Yeah, not
special
a knitter.
Special skills? Not a knitter, my friend. Mm-mm.
And I'm starting my own business, actually, K-N-O-T, not a knitter. So,
dude,
I mean,
that's funny.
Is that a high five?
Yes,
I got a high five for
that's
that.
That's a good one. Not a spit take, but a high five.
So I usually try to do emails, respond to emails that, you know.
I feel like it took you a while to get the pick and bio over, but
yeah,
whatever.
It did. Yeah. It did. I'm slow. I'm very slow.
You need the 2.5 hours.
I should just have something that's an automatic start of every email. I'm sorry it took so long to get back to you. I think that's like something that just should start my emails.
And then it's on the bottom it's www.knotakniteer.com.
That's right. It's exploding.
Yes.
It's exploding.
So you write emails, you correspond with people. I imagine there's a lot of fan mail to answer.
Not really.
I can't imagine that.
There's
so.
Some. There's
yeah.
some.
You're not writing a script.
I'm always in the process of working on something. There's a couple of things I'm working on right now.
So I want to give you a deadline because I feel for me it's really important whenever I'm writing something. If someone says, you know what, Alana, I need 3 pages,
right?
3 chapters, 3 pages, 3 scenes by like a certain day. So when it's said out loud, and this is on air,
right,
and thousands of
right.
people listen to this,
right,
I have a request.
What's the deadline?
I feel like...
Just get to it. Come on, just rip the Band-Aid off,
I
please.
I want, in 2 weeks...
2 weeks.
I want to see a scene.
A scene, okay.
Just know, like, it's not just America listening to this show. This is radio waves.
Yeah.
This is international. Like, if you saw the demographics and the geography, we're talking Singapore, we're talking Bahrain, we're talking Hoboken.
You may be single-handedly responsible for actually making my writing career give
your
it a
wife foothold. Has been calling. She's like, please, he sits there. I don't know. It's like, what is he
doing? He sits there not responding to emails.
Exactly. Do you have like a horrible audition story?
Oh God. I have a lot of audition stories.
Do you have one? Like, what's the first one that comes to your mind that maybe it's funny now?
Well, there's a lot of them. I mean, I've told a few, so I wanted to kind of reach into my bag and find some stories that I hadn't.
Do you
told.
Want a minute to get your bag?
It's right over here.
Okay.
It's a tiny, small bag filled with knitting needles
and
yarn
stories.
And horror
yeah.
stories. One story is that Spike Lee was directing a play not so long ago, maybe 5 years ago. I can't remember if it actually came to be. Do you remember this? He was going to direct it. It was a war play set in the 40s. And
I wasn't seen for it. That's my horrible audition story. I didn't even know it was happening.
If you had been seen, perhaps this would have happened
to
you.
That's right.
I had read this about Spike Lee, and I knew this about him. He has on set, he has a no phones rule. And if your phone goes off, you have to put money in a can in a can. I don't know if it's a can.
It's like an old Folgers coffee can. I'm sure
that's what
it is. Yeah.
Do people know what cans are anymore? Have we gone so far into the future?
You know what?
I doubt it. Anyway,
into a receptacle
Thank
of some
you.
Kind.
That's right. That leaves it open.
Yes.
Anyway, I knew this about him, and I'm auditioning for this role in a play about the war, World War II in the 40s, and my phone goes off in my pocket. And at first you think, am I going to be one of those people that just tries to pretend it's not me? You know, just like you let it ring, just like some idiot's not picking up their phone. It becomes impossible not to acknowledge the fact that my phone is ringing. And so I say, I'm so sorry. Let me turn off the phone. And Spike Lee says, you know, I have a thing that I do in my set. Do you know what happens on my set? You know, if that happens? And I said, actually, Mr. Lee, I do. I do know I know your policy about this. And he goes, yeah, you gotta pony up. And I said, I feel so terrible. I'm willing to give you everything that's in my wallet right now, and I want to give that to you right now. And I opened my wallet and I said, I can give you $2. I had $2 in my wallet. And he said, no, thank you. And then I finished the scene and I didn't get it. But that's the gist of it.
When it happened, when the phone rings, are you like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah. I think that quite often in auditions. And something weird with me about those moments is that this may be the secret of my success or it may be my downfall.
You know, it's just a series of humiliations. This is what I want to say before we say goodbye. I feel like if you want something magical to happen to a project of yours, you put Brian in it. Anyway, Brian, thank you so much for coming on.
You'll know what I'm doing when I'm not on stage. You're not answering your emails.
But there better be pages.
That's right? True. 3 weeks, was it?
I think I said two.
Two.
But I think that's adorable that you thought it was three.
Interesting how I heard that.
One line of King George. Will you sing will you sing us out with your favorite moment?
Oh, I'll do it in falsetto.
Great.
Just because it's...
Well,
because
of the time of day.
Yes. You say our love is draining and you can't go on. I love that part.
Is that so satisfying?
Fun.
Is it as satisfying to do as it was
for
me to
just... I will never be satisfied. I can't go to bed. I mean, my head is just like spinning with every song in the show. I mean, it's a great way to go to sleep. But then you wake up thinking, you know, ba-ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. You know, just everything in the show is like, it just
non-stop.
Infects you. It's nonstop. See, you got it too.
Skyless Sisters.
Hamilton okay. Disease.
I mean, all right, we got to go.
We do.
I have to let you go do a matinee.
I got to go do a show.
There are people who have been waiting for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Alana.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast, and on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hangar Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc. Thanks again to our sponsor, Dear Evan Hansen. With its moving score and unforgettable characters, this show is intensely personal, universal, deeply moving, and has touched audiences in ways few Broadway musicals ever have. The winner of 6 Tony Awards, including Best Musical of the Year, will not only make you stand up and cheer, but will stay with you long after you leave the theater.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.